This is Homefront, South Dakota. If you could please give me your name, age, and your hometown.
I'm Delmer Dooley. I'm 87 years old and I come from Ramona, South Dakota.
Can you please give me your branch of service, your rank, and unit you served with?
I joined the Army Air Force. At that time, it was part of the Army, and so it was the Army Air Force. I enlisted in 1942, shortly after war broke out. I was the engineer on the 17, and I earned a rank of tech sergeant while overseas.
Now, I guess first question is, did you know anything about what was happening in Europe around the world before Pearl Harbor happened?
Yes, I was going to a technical school in North Dakota, and in the evening we'd listen to the radio. Hitler was threatening the nearby countries, particularly Poland. That was the main, and also he was trying to regain the Rhineland that the Germans lost in World War I. We were all concerned.
Did you think America should have gotten involved before Pearl Harbor? We should
No,
have.
I don't think the most Americans didn't feel that was our war. It was in Europe, and it didn't seem that it was affecting us at that point.
When did you go into the service?
Well, war was declared in December of 1941, and shortly thereafter, I went down and enlisted because I thought that was the right thing to do. They said, "We'll call you to active duty. You can go back to your back, and we'll give you a call." So it was pretty near 60 or 90 days later before I got a call.
How did your family take you going to war?
Both my brother and I enlisted. He enlisted in the Navy and I enlisted in the Air Force shortly after the war broke out. He chose the Navy, he told me, well, he said, "I like to box. The Navy has a big boxing program, and so I'd like to join that." I said, "That's not for me. I'm more interested in joining the Air Force because I hope someday to own a plane."
How was training for you for going to the Army Air Force at the time? What was that like leaving from tech school into training?
Well, my tech school was a one-year course, and it was auto and diesel mechanics. And my goal at that point was to diesel was just coming into its own in the late 30s. This was in 39 and 40, and I thought that was and I was fascinated by the diesel engine, and I've heard lots of things that it would be a growing field, and that was my pre-qualification, I suppose. I went out to the West Coast. Lockheed, but before joining the Lockheed, I went to Santa Monica Technical School. They were training for aircraft, and I thought this sounds good, so I went to that technical training school, and from there Lockheed hired me, and I was sent to the 3G's plant, which were making the P-38. It was a fighter plane that was a twin engine, twin boom. We turned out the very first ones, and the day they flew that. They were about 150 of us at the 3G's plant, and they called us out to the parking lot and said, "You'll see a demonstration of the plane that's been built." And the P-38 came and zoomed straight up. We thought it was awesome to what this plane could do. About 2 years later, why, on my bomb runs, why, here was the P-38 again. I thought, what a coincidence that I helped build the first of them, and here they are. Flying cover for our against the German fighters, and they'd pick us up, particularly on the way back. We had Mustangs would pick us up to go to the target. The P-38 had a longer range, and they would pick us up right after we're the target and get us back to the coast.
How was training the Air
Yeah,
Force?
well, I was first sent to Minner Field at Bakersfield for I think it was Vol T-13s. I was signed to work as a mechanic there, so I learned how to take care, do 10, 25, 50, and 100-hour maintenance on planes. From there, then they sent me to gunnery school, and that was in Nevada, and we spent one winter training as gunners and aircraft identification. Much of the time was spent in a dark room to identify friendly and unfriendly planes. We got to know the Messerschmitt 109 and 1010 and the Focke Wulf, and then just before the war ended they had a jet. And the last, I think, one mission I had, it was jets came. These planes could go 400 or 500 miles an hour, and you're going 150, 160 miles an hour. So you have to make an identification in a hurry that you don't shoot friendly planes. And we had that down pretty good. We knew the Mustang and the P-38. P-38 was the only twin boom, so that was an easy one. And all the Mustangs, most of them had red tails, and we called it, it's either a red tail or a twin boom. We knew those were our side.
So where did you spend most of your time at in the European front? What where were where did you do your missions?
Most of the 15th Air Force was based in Italy, and ours was a 301st Bomb Group, and we were based near Foggia, at a small olive orchard. We lived in tents, and we had the tarmac, or they laid down these steel platings and each plane was in a revetment so that it couldn't be blocked, or if it hit one, it wouldn't go to others, because they're each one was put about 60 or 100 feet away from each other. I lived there just about a year.
So, how many missions did you participate in?
Well, I had the allotment was 50 missions. They were broken down in singles and doubles. If we hit a target such as Vienna, that counted as two missions. Some of those were hit just a marshaling yard or a bridge in which Germans were trying to flee from Italy. Why, those would be generally a one mission. So at the end, you had to have 30 some times over the target. But I would take two singles compared to going to Regensburg or Vienna or Brux. Some of those, they were heavily defended. Vienna and that area, the oil areas was where they stockpile the oil, and they had tremendous flak guns in that. No matter what direction we came in to drop the bombs, we were getting flak. And flak, is the anti-aircraft. They sent up some fighter planes to go in and get some photos of what's going on. And we found out the Germans had built a railroad around the whole oil complex, about 300 miles. So no matter what direction you come, of course they had spy planes out, and they would tell the direction, here come the bombers, and what from their direction. And that train then would come in from whether we come from the north or south or east. Here was this flak, and then we found out they had these guns mounted on a railroad track circling the oil compounds.
Can you explain like what kind of airplane you were in?
The B-17 is a 10-man crew. It carried a navigator and a bombardier in the nose, and the cockpit was the pilot, the co-pilot, and the engineer, and I was the engineer on that. And then behind the bulkhead and the bombs was the radio operator. There were two gunners on each side of the plane, and then a ball turret. And that ball turret was retractable. When we got in enemy territory, why, the fellow got in that ball, he curled up it was a tight fit, and the ball then could be lowered. He'd have a 360-degree view of the plane from underneath it. And the last one was the tail gunner. He laid on his stomach in the back and had two twin 50 caliber guns to protect the rear. That was our team.
How close were you to your squad members,
Well,
friends
you
that way?
bond pretty fast. When you're all on the same plane and you're shot at, you have a tremendous feeling. Each person has a job to do. It depends on all 10 of them to do their job. The bombardier had 50 calibers in his. The navigator, sometimes we had, depending on how new we were. And of course, to protect the plane from all, I had twin 50s in the top turret, right above. I sat between the pilot and the co-pilot, and then I had a jump seat in between. In enemy territory, I got in the ball turret, and my job was to watch from the top.
What was like, I guess, your most memorable or like harrowing mission that you had to do? Like, you think you really had a fear of your life being in that plane with those people?
Almost every time you were under a strain. The toughest one was Vienna. And when we got word that we had the early morning briefing, the pilot came out and he quickly told us what our target was. And Vienna was probably the toughest of all. The oil there was, as I understand, they were producing 870 million gallons of fuel. And after the bombing, the Germans said, "You destroyed our ability on the land and in the air, because you reduced our whole total fuel to about 70 million gallons, and that didn't take care of the ground troops or the tanks and all others. The whole goal was strategic bombing. Bomb where it hurt them the most. The others was Brooks. I think that was a ball bearing factory that most of the fine precision type ball bearings were made there. We bombed that a number of times. Vienna was the most feared of all. We were always quiet in the plane, very little talking outside of, we had to take check every few minutes, and that's about it. And then when the flak come up, when we see a plane go down, we thought, thank God it's not ours at all. Got back to base, you spent time wondering, what will you do if you get shot down? All the way from having suitable shoes to walk if you are able to bail out and are fortunate enough to land and be alive, and you're picked up by friendly people, quite a few, and they then had a night trail. Each night they would take you over the mountains into, I believe, Adriatic, and the British then had ships, had small ships come in at night and pick you up and bring you back to, and quite a few of them did. A couple of times we went over to Barry, especially when we knew some friends, some of our co-patriots that were shot down, we heard they were over at Barry. We went over to find out, listen, what do we do if we get shot down? And we got a lot of good, helpful information. Particularly, they said, be sure you have a good pair of shoes. Well, we had heated suits, and the heated suits have a shoe. It's just a felt shoe. And he said, they told us in a matter of a few hours, that isn't any good when you're going to have to walk mountains. I took a pair of GI shoes and rope and tied them under my arm, one under each arm. And the reason for the rope, they said it's good to have a rope because you're going to have to travel at night, and these guides are going to take you over the mountains. And if you've got a rope, at least you can hang on to stay in line with them a little bit, because you don't know the way at all. And it's going to be dark, and you're trying to get around enemy people that are on the ground.
How did you feel about the enemy you were fighting at the time? And I guess, how do you feel about those countries that you're in now and those former enemies?
Well, in 1955, I went to the Near East and worked in the Near East, and we landed in Germany. And it was a funny feeling to go back there 10 years later and land in the same town that was bombed. I think it was Frankfurt. But after you're there a few hours, that went away. But the thinking that we're going to land in an enemy town, and 10 years isn't much time because it's still pretty fresh in here. And we saw still quite a bit of damage that the bombs had done.
What do you want people to know today about your experience and what you felt and thought in the war? What do you think they should know about your feelings during that time?
That's a tough question. I feel fortunate that I was one of those that flew the 50 missions and came back. You can't help but think of why me and why so many others didn't make it. And the day we were briefed before we started mission, the final briefing we had, why the colonel came in and he said, look around at your crew. He said, our losses are averaging 2 out of 10 of 10 men. So it may be better or it may be worse. So that made you think too. Let's see, think it's 2 out of our 10. We had, within about 3 months, we lost 2 of our men. We lost our navigator. And fortunately, they were short navigators. And he flew on a mission with us. He flew on another, and he was shot down. About a month later, Lieutenant Gubitosi was our bombardier. The Brits had a base nearby, and they did night bombing. They had planes that were quiet. They were short. They wanted to bombardier. So Gubitosi had been sick, so he was way behind the rest of us on total number of missions. So he volunteered, and his plane, he was shot down. We never heard any more until after, years afterwards, the classification of all the work was released. And I found out that Lieutenant Parker, the navigator, was shot down, and he was a prisoner of war almost from the time within within a month or two after he'd gotten there. And Gubitosi was, his mission was somewhere in Italy, and he was shot down. And he also survived. And after the war, we found out that he had been a prisoner. Both those men were prisoner. We didn't, all 10 of ours did come back.
What do we need to remember about World War II?
That's a difficult one. I think often I was born in 1920, had nothing but a series of wars throughout my life. I never once expected when I graduated from high school that it was going to be one series of war after the other. When World War II ended, made a strong request and came and talked to you to stay in the military. Well, I had a good position, and fortunately I didn't take it. But I think of many of the World War II veterans did. They stayed in, and a few years later they had the Korean War. Following that, they had the Vietnam War. And it's just one series. Somehow, why do we have to have a whole lifetime of war? There must be something that can make it work better than that. You know, Woodrow Wilson put his faith in the League of Nations. Shortly after the war, we had the United Nations. It helped. And I think it has to be a multinational group, because if one country can't preserve a peace, it's going to take unity of some sort. And I think one of the things that, you know, Mussolini said, he told the Italians, we had Italian prisoners at our camp. We asked him, why did you think you could go to war and win? He said, Mussolini told us, tighten your belts and we'll have food for everybody. If that's part of the question and part of the answer is in people having food for breakfast, some of them, we see lots of hunger. And I worked after years, I joined the Near East Foundation and spent 28 years with the Near East Foundation in the Middle East. And I was also assigned to Korea after the war. You see so much poverty. And this is certainly something that has to be given more effort, more resources. Many have said, if a person has a full stomach, he's not going to fight. He's not going to be the first person to fight or want to. But what do they have to lose if they don't even have food?
Is there anything else you'd like to add that I maybe haven't asked you?
No, the government treated me well. I think we were well prepared I had a tremendous amount of training before going over there. So I felt very confident in carrying my job out. Afterwards, we had the GI Bill. I came back and I had a year of college, and I've graduated with a bachelor's degree under it. Then I got a master's degree from Colorado. And then later on, I got a doctor's degree from the University of Missouri. So our government has treated the soldier and the serviceman, in most cases, the opportunity was there. Whether they took advantage of it or used it to help them in making a good life, that was up to them. But many of them had the opportunity. They had low-cost loans to buy homes and all sorts of help to get started in their career or chosen field.